Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. Financial reform, endless oil spill, a spy chief out, and elections under the microscope this week. The Senate finally pushed through financial reform. Here's Senator Dick Durbin today.
We have a vision that this America will never have to face a recession again as we're going through now. And this bill will help insulate America from that sort of challenge in the future.
Fury over the Gulf spill and oil on the Louisiana coast now. Here's Governor Bobby Jindal.
This is serious. This is the heavy oil that everybody's been fearing. It is here now.
And American voters speak. Tea Partier Rand Paul's in the race. So is Democrat Joe Sestak, who upended Senator Arlen Specter in the Democratic primary.
This is what democracy looks like.
This hour, On Point, our weekly news roundtable goes behind the headlines. You can join the conversation. Do you feel safer with financial reform rolling forward? What's your takeaway from Tuesday's voting? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Washington is Susan Glasser, editor-in-chief of Foreign Policy Magazine. Susan, welcome to On Point.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Also from Washington, Jonathan Wiseman, White House reporter for the Wall Street Journal. Jonathan, welcome back.
I'm happy to be here, Tom.
And with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at The Atlantic. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Susan, and Jonathan.
Let's go straight to this financial reform package, pro, con, and maybe a little in the middle. Here's President Obama yesterday afternoon as news came that the long-awaited financial reform was advancing in the Senate.
And there will be new rules to prevent financial institutions from becoming too big to fail in the first place, so that we don't have another AIG. Because of reform, the kinds of complex backroom deals that helped trigger the financial crisis will finally be brought to the light of day. And from now on, shareholders will have greater say on the pay of CEOs and other executives, so that they can reward success instead of failure and help change the perverse incentives that encourage so much reckless risk-taking in the first place.
Final vote, 59 to 39, with a couple of Republicans coming in. There are a couple of Democrats sitting on their hands. Here's one Republican who did not vote for the bill. Wyoming Senator Michael Enzi voted against the regulatory reform bill, said yesterday in the Senate the bill creates more problems than it solves. Too much government.
This is a brand new bureau. We don't have enough government. We're going to start a whole new bureau. And we're going to turn everything financial over to that bureau.
There you go. Jonathan Wiseman, is the White House happy? Do they see it coming, what they want to see coming? I mean, there's criticism from Republicans right there. Some liberals saying it's not hard enough on too big to fail.
The White House is ecstatic. You know, unlike the health care debate, the White House really controlled this legislation and really controlled the message as well. Remember, in June, just about a year ago, the Treasury Department and the White House sent up thousands of pages of legislative language on this. And the House and the Senate worked off that. So this was not a, you know, build-it-yourself on Capitol Hill deal. This is the administration's bill with a few embellishments. So the White House is very happy. I mean, remember, you know, the president had five big initiatives that he laid out at the very beginning of his administration. Everyone kind of gasped at the expanse of them. And if he gets this, and it looks like he will, he'll have gotten four out of those five, which is pretty impressive.
Not a bad score. Jack Beatty, what about the vote? 59 to 39. No filibuster here, interestingly. Two Democrats not voting for this. Maria Cantwell, a senator of Washington State, and Senator Russ Feingold, Wisconsin, of course. Three Republicans jumping on, Jack, to help push it through. Susan Collins and Olympia Snowe of Maine, Scott Brown, newly elected from Massachusetts, and Chuck Grassley of Iowa, Jack.
Yes, I was surprised to see Senator Brown because in the last couple of weeks of his campaign, his candidacy received a fillip of 400 and some odd thousand dollars from the financial industry to sort of get him over the the finish line, and I thought, I wonder how he'll vote. But he clearly voted his conscience and his constituency, and a very big win for the president. You know, Secretary Summers this week said the bill would have prevented the Wall Street theft of American prosperity that happened in 2007, 2008. But Nouriel Roubini, who, mm-hmm. unlike Larry Summers, was right.
The economist
about,
who called it.
Who
mm-hmm.
called it. Mm-hmm. He calls it cosmetic, and he says it's absurd to think that a company the size of Goldman Sachs, which operates in nearly 100 countries, that a government could accept the failure of that company. He says it's too big to fail, too big to be bailed out, and too big to manage risk properly, and that leaving these big banks intact is a crucial mistake.
This goes to the House or to a committee to work it out between the Senate and House now, but strong anticipation this will happen. Jonathan, how is the White House? You cover it. How are they reading Scott Brown? Tea Party hero Scott Brown. We'll talk in this hour about Tea Party hero Rand Paul, but what about Scott Brown and this vote?
I think that they realized fairly early on after his election that Scott Brown wasn't the catastrophe that they were expecting. In fact, they kind of think of him as the best thing that's happened to him for a while because, you know, they have a Republican. This vote wasn't as close as it sounds. Remember, mm-hmm. two of the Democrats who would have voted for it didn't show up. Arlen Specter, who is still nursing his defeat here, and Robert Byrd, who was basically too ill. If they needed him, it needed them, they would have shown up. So they actually had more than 60 votes.
Filibuster
you know,
proof.
Scott, mm-hmm. Yeah, Scott Brown is a big help to them right now because they look at it and they say, look, the guy is still a Republican in Massachusetts who's going to be up for re-election in 2012. If he really values being a United States senator, he's not going to simply toe the line of a Mitch McConnell.
Susan Glasser, you've got your eye on the whole world. Europe, of course, absolutely a mess around the euro right now. In American markets all over the place, plummeting as a result. How do you think this regulation step in the United States factors into that whole big market story that's swirling around us right now, Susan?
Well, I think the timing is certainly very interesting. What's happening in Europe is really a massive both economic and political crisis mm-hmm. surrounding the Eurozone. The very unanticipated negative consequences of this decision taken more than a decade ago. Look at what's happening in Germany as they come to terms with the idea that they're going to have to bail out, in effect, their southern neighbors. And I think what's interesting is that can any one country's regulatory bill, such as this financial reform package passed in the U.S., really have a major systemic effect at this point? You know, looking at the Chinese central bankers commenting on the euro crisis yesterday and saying, you know, we're not going to release our currency until the euro guys figure their thing out more. And I think you have a sense of just how globalized the risk has become and the fact that you're not going to have any legislature, even the Congress of the United States, that's going to be able to put that genie back in the bottle.
Jack, do you expect to hear Republicans saying that the Obama administration has regulated Wall Street into the ditch? The market's pretty far down. Or is that on Europe's plate?
I think perhaps substantively it's on Europe's plate. Politically, you may well hear that from Republicans. I think, though, they've got to ask themselves the question, do they really want to persist in seeming to carry water for Wall Street right now? I mean, mm-hmm. Surely there are more promising political departures they could take than that one.
Rand Paul knows that. I want to go to the Director of National Intelligence, who is out, Dennis Blair. Resigned is the word, Jonathan Weissman, but I guess canned is the fact. What happened?
Well, you know, Dennis Blair never was a very good fit with this administration. Barack Obama really likes the guys who are close to him, who have been with him through the campaign, through thick and thin. Early on, John Brennan, who was his counterterrorism chief in the White House, became the focal point of intelligence and counterterrorism policy. Leon Panetta, who is seen as extremely capable at CIA, at kind of deftly managing the bureaucratic morass that is the intelligence community. Dennis Blair was always kind of the odd man out, and I think that they were looking for a time and a way to move him out, and it was a perfect time, really, because nobody was watching.
But is this just a personality issue, or do we have functional problems in American intelligence?
Well, you know, we do have functional problems. I mean, that's when Abdulmutallab, the Christmas Day underwear bomber, was caught and failed to blow up a Northwest airliner. The problem, as the president readily admitted, was that, you know, he had snuck through the cracks of the intelligence community. It was all about connecting the dots. They connected the dots and still didn't catch the guy. At that time, John Brennan appeared to be the man who was going to take responsibility. It was interesting at that time when they said, and when Brennan said, "I'll take the bullet. This was my fault." Dennis Blair was nowhere to be found, but there was a report that came out this week from the Senate Intelligence Committee looking at the flaws of the Abdulmutallab investigation. That one really plopped the blame on the DNI, who the Director of National Intelligence was created to bring all of these disparate wings of the intelligence community together, and he didn't do it. And I think that report was a pretext in some sense to move on what the president had wanted to do for some time.
Susan Glasser, we'll look at the Koreas in just a minute and what's going on there. But Jack, how about it? Jonathan Weissman says here's President Obama with 4 out of his 5 goals in gear. Now he's master of the intelligence realm, you know, sort of sending the guy out to pasture when he didn't live up to his expectations. Is he looking large and in charge or something else?
Well, he certainly looks that way in terms of the achievements. He just doesn't seem to be getting enough credit, at least the credit you'd think he would get, from the electorate. And that, of course, is for the stubbornly unresponsive economy. The 9.9% unemployment now. And the public just is in no mood to say, well, yeah, it's great you've done financial reforms, great you've done health care and the rest of these things. But what have you done for my economic security? And the answer is, they don't see that he's done much.
Well, maybe more than that, Rand Paul saying today that President Obama's criticism of BP over the oil spill sounds really un-American. We'll look at that and much more. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news. Finance reform passes the Senate. The top U.S. intelligence chief is out. Voters speak. And the oil blowout gushes on in the Gulf. Susan Glasser, editor-in-chief of Foreign Policy Magazine, is with us from Washington. And White House correspondent for The Wall Street Journal, Jonathan Weissman, is here. Jack Beatty as well. Big report came out this week, said North Korea torpedo looks like the reason that ship went down. South Korean ship with 46 dead in March. Here's a statement yesterday from South Korea's Vice Minister of Foreign Affairs and Trade, Chung Yong-woo.
This is an armed attack, an act of aggression. We believe that North Korea should not be allowed to get away with this. And I think this is serious enough to require condemnation, a universal condemnation from the international community.
And here's Secretary of State Hillary Clinton in the region speaking out today on the same subject in Tokyo.
Provocative actions have consequences. We cannot allow this attack to go unanswered by the international community.
So what kind of answer? Susan Glasser, Secretary of State Clinton, talking with Japan, Korea, of course, China. What might come here? And could it go to a clash, or is that just inconceivable given the stakes?
Well, first of all, nothing is inconceivable. Secretary Clinton is on her 5th trip to Asia, planned long before, obviously. I do think this Korea controversy is likely to perhaps dominate the trip. And in particular, the question is China. What is China going to do? You remember Kim Jong-il, the reclusive leader of North Korea, just took his train trip to China, but reports have come out of China suggesting it did not go well. Chinese pressing for a greater role, insight into the economy there. At the same time, they have been very reluctant to join in international activities to condemn North Korea in recent years. South Korea is now very aggressively pushing for some kind of a UN Security Council resolution, and I think part of the goal of Secretary Clinton's trip is going to end up being what kind of a coalition can she put together to support the South Koreans without further escalating a pretty dangerous situation.
Jonathan, is that enough? North Korea apparently torpedoes a South Korean Navy ship and 46 dead on that South Korean ship. Is a UN Security Council condemnation sufficient?
It's remarkable, but the fact is that the South Koreans have a gun to their head. If you've ever been to Seoul, you'll see it.
Yep.
And you know, this isn't Iraq here. They've got a nuclear armed neighbor just to the north, within artillery range of their largest city in the capital. And their hands are very tied. If you've ever been to South Korea, you realize what an incredibly difficult situation it is to be dealing with an irrational government to the north that seems willing to do just about anything.
Missiles in minutes could rain down on the South Korean capital there. But what a picture. All those dead, a torpedo in the ship down. And talking to the UN, let's talk about American politics and Tuesday. Jack, what did you take away from it in the end, Tuesday's election?
Well, you know, it seems to me it was a very good day for the Democrats, perhaps not for the president, candidates whom he endorsed lost, but for the party in Pennsylvania, the congressional district, in the Joe Sestak senatorial nomination, a stronger candidate, I think, in the fall, the polls seem to suggest, against the Republican, and then perhaps even a strong candidate emerging in Arkansas in the challenge against Senator Lincoln. So, and I think the best news of all for the Democrats was the victory of Rand Paul in Kentucky.
Best news? This isn't the Tea Party juggernaut coming after them?
No, it turns out this is taken as the face of the Tea Party, then the Republican Party and the Tea Party movement have problems. You know, Mark Twain once said that he wanted to be in Kentucky when the end of the world came because Kentucky was always 20 years behind. Well, it looks like Rand Paul wants to take the country 50, 60 years behind. Up until 48 hours ago, seeming to espouse the idea that, you know, it's all right for private businesses to discriminate on the basis of race, even though, of course, that's against the Civil Rights Act. This is the kind of eccentric, extreme position that's been growing in the hothouse atmosphere of the Tea Party, but hasn't yet emerged until now on the political stage where there's another side, where the other side can debate it. And it may well be that in the Kentucky contest, Paul could lose what looked like a sure seat just on the grounds of his extremism, and nationally it may just give the whole Tea Party an image it doesn't want.
You call it extremism, but of course Kentucky Republicans put him in there over Trey Grayson, who is a more mainstream Republican. Let's go to Patrick in Clover, South Carolina. Patrick, you're on the air.
I couldn't disagree more with that, your colleague there. You know, this smear tactic from the left, you know, I listened to Rand Paul on the MSNBC show formulating his position on the Civil Rights Act. He said foursquare that he was for the majority of the bill, but there was one section that he had a reservation. Let me pose this question to you.
Yes, sir.
Is a private ownership of a restaurant allowed to discriminate against a dress code, say? Say somebody comes in there that has a bad hygiene. Is he allowed to discriminate?
Are you saying then that the restaurant should be allowed to discriminate when it comes to skin color, race?
No, but that was never Rand Paul's position. He agreed. He said time and time again that he was against discrimination on race, and now the people on the left who like to get mileage and traction to kind of smear the right. It was totally untrue and unwarranted. I didn't hear that come from Rand Paul. This is my problem, and I'm not a Tea Party member, but I like Rand Paul and his positions as far as putting the yoke on the federal government and the purview of the federal government into the lives of the Americans. And that's what it appeals to a lot of conservative libertarians like myself.
Patrick, we hear it, and certainly that's his message. Let's go to the tape and hear a bit of what he, in fact, said. This was Rand Paul, the Tea Party-backed candidate. Here he is talking about the Civil Rights Act with Rachel Maddow on MSNBC.
I'm not in favor of any discrimination of any form. I would never belong to any club that excluded anybody for race. We still do have private clubs in America that can discriminate based on race. But I think what's important about this debate is not getting into any specific gotcha on this, but asking the question, what about freedom of speech? Should we limit speech from people we find abhorrent? Should we limit racists from speaking?
Jonathan Weissman, play referee here. You're with the Wall Street Journal. What did you hear in Rand Paul's comments there? He's been, you know, talking a lot since and sort of refining those comments. What did you hear, Jonathan?
You know, I traveled with Rand Paul last week. And if you listen to him, he has this... We has this very strict ideology of libertarianism, and it goes, you know, much broader than this. It goes to whether there should be an OSHA, an Occupational mm-hmm. Safety and Health Administration, whether there should the EPA has the right to regulate to regulate the workplace, to regulate carbon emissions. And you know he traces it back to 1937 when the Supreme Court, for the first time after a string of setbacks for Franklin Delano Roosevelt, ruled that the states did have a right to establish a minimum wage. And he says basically that's where we kind of went to heck. He is extremely consistent on that basically the government does not have the right to tell the private sector what to do. This is the Paul race is going to be fascinating because Rand Paul, you know, after the party leadership got to him yesterday, he went on first the Laura Ingraham show, mm-hmm. and then he went on CNN and he said, no, I would have voted for the Civil Rights Act, but then immediately the next day, this morning, he went on Good Morning America and he was very critical of Barack Obama's criticism of British Petroleum, of BP, and said that that the criticism of BP's response to the oil spill smacked of anti-business bias, and that sometimes accidents just happen. Rand Paul's candidacy is going to be a fascinating argument over the scope of government and basically whether the government has a role in the U.S. private sector. It's going to be a very interesting case. And I'll tell you, this is going to be an extremely, extremely close contest between Jack Conway, the Attorney General mm-hmm. of Kentucky, and Rand Paul.
He certainly marches to his own drummer. There is a lot of upset over that oil in the Gulf. But Rand Paul, as you say, criticizing President Obama's handling of that debacle as, quote, quoting Rand Paul, putting his boot heel on the throat of BP. It was on NPR on Wednesday. Robert Siegel, on All Things Considered, asked him about the 1964 Civil Rights Act and the Americans with Disabilities Act, asked if they were overreaches.
I think a lot of things could be handled locally. For example, I think that we should try to do everything we can to allow for people with disabilities and handicaps. You know, we do it in our office with wheelchair ramps and things like that. I think if you have a two-story office and you hire someone who's handicapped, it might be reasonable to let them have an office on the first floor rather than the government saying you have to have a $100,000 elevator.
Let's go to our listeners, Pam in Stanton, Virginia. Pam, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I'm thrilled. First time I got through.
Great, welcome.
I just wanted to say that my huge concern right now, particularly after this week, is that where are the moderate voices? It just seems to me that what we are going to have is more polarization, more ideologues on both sides, and I think the majority of the country is, as Kathleen Parker has said, a little right of center. I remember when Mark Warner, our former governor, was running for the Senate, his campaign was he was going to Washington to be a radical centrist.
Mm-hmm.
And I can
nobody's saying that now.
No. And I think that's what the American people really want. We want people that can act like grown-ups and work on both sides of the aisle. And everybody talks about bipartisan. I haven't seen any of it recently. And what we see are people digging in their heels and just opposing each other.
Pam, we've got it loud and clear.
Something?
Yes, Jonathan.
The Wall Street regulation bill that passed last night, although it only had a handful of Republicans, it was a very interesting process because after the House had passed their bill, they actually broke up into these dyads where Mark Warner, the Democrat of Virginia, was teamed with Bob Corker, the Republican of Tennessee. Chuck Schumer, Democrat of New York, was teamed with Judd Gregg, Republican of New Hampshire. Shelby of Alabama was seen with Chris Dodd. They had these four dyads, and they negotiated and negotiated and negotiated. And, you know, in the end, they didn't come up with a truly bipartisan bill. But I think that that process was really helpful in getting the bill across without the kind of rancor that you saw in the health care debate. Bipartisanship, or at least cooperation, is possible. And I think that what we saw with the financial regulation bill is indicative of what can be done in the United States Senate if the process is set up to do it.
Are you telling our caller, Pam, to take heart then if she wants to see more of that centrism underway? Is that the message in the Tuesday vote?
Absolutely. And remember, you know, for every Rand Paul that might be elected in the fall, you're also going to have a Mike Castle from Delaware who's a strong who's strongly favored in Delaware. He's an extremely moderate Republican. You'll have you might have a Mark Kirk of Illinois who's a very soft-spoken moderate Republican. Kelly Ayotte in New Hampshire. There is, you know, for all of the polarization, there is another movement going on afoot in the middle, and I think that we can't lose sight of that.
Jack, do you see, is it really extremism in Rand Paul's case? Is it common sense in some cases? I mean, what about his comments to Robert Siegel? It's, you know, the Disabilities Act has been hailed and has made many people's lives great, and then he says, well, but if you've got a two-story office, you hire somebody who's handicapped, instead of having to build a $100,000 elevator, why don't you just put their office on the first floor?
Wonderful, invincible common sense. But you know, sort of aside the point, this is a settled issue. President Bush the First was the proponent of the Americans with Disabilities Act. It was a great achievement. It opened doors to people who've been left out of the out of opportunity, and I think people value that. But to come along and in the name of abstract property rights, oh well, yes, you have to put in the $100,000, but over time you pay that off with the customers who can come in. But you know, with him basically, it's abstract property rights over people. I mean, that's not really an American tradition. That's taking a good thought, property rights, a bit too far.
Let's go to Brian in Dorchester, Massachusetts. Brian, you're on the air.
Yes, hello. I'm calling because I was shocked by the language that Senator Reid and President Obama were using to tout this Wall Street reform bill, basically promising things they can't promise. You had Senator Durbin at the top of the program saying this is going to prevent the type of recession that we're experiencing right now.
That's a big promise.
Promises that politicians can't make. And my question for the panel is, is this bill really going to break up any of the big banks and get rid of too big to fail, as I'm hearing them say? And why is President Obama, who I've been a strong supporter of, being not really straightforward about this success? I think this hits on what Jack was talking about, not being able to take credit. Maybe it's because they pretend they're delivering the moon when they're really just giving some common sense reforms that won't really break up big institutions.
Jack Beatty, what do you say? The Federal Reserve has given more oversight of big institutions here, that's for sure. But of course, they had some power before, and we saw what happened. Is Obama overstating what he's delivering here?
I mean, it just seems to me the case that they are overstating it. I mean, to say a priori, this will prevent too big to fail, this will protect the society against Wall Street, that you can't make that claim and leave these six banks with holdings, I think, approaching, you know, in the trillions. You just can't do it. It's interesting to see how this is treated abroad. I listened to the BBC just before this show, and the interviewer said, "Well, what's the bottom line? What are people saying?" And the BBC reporter said, "A victory for Wall Street." That's not the way it's being represented here. Yes, there are obviously good things in the bill, and yes, just simply the transparency over the dark markets of derivatives, that's a great, you know, gain. But let's not kid ourselves that somehow this prevents what we saw, where, you know, the taxpayer was on the hook for billions and billions of dollars.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, moms of the three imprisoned American hikers went to Iran to visit their children, put on burqas, spoke very carefully.
We know that this is a great humanitarian act that they've given to us. Our reception was wonderful when we came into Iran.
Miss USA this year, Rima Fakir. She's from a Muslim family from Dearborn, Michigan.
They're very proud of me. They take it as if I'm not, you know, up there for beauty or to pose in a bathing suit, but for something more significant.
And in Thailand, a hard government crackdown on protesters amid days of turmoil. We're looking at a week in the news with Susan Glasser, editor-in-chief of Foreign Policy magazine. Jonathan Weissman covers the White House for the Wall Street Journal. Jack Beatty's here. Susan Glasser, we've got a lot to ask you about abroad, and let's start right off with Afghanistan, the 1,000th U.S. casualty there this week. And the U.S. military appears to be backing off its more aggressive language about activities focused on Kandahar. Here's General Stanley McChrystal late last week trying to characterize the approach.
We're not using the term operation or major operations because that often brings to mind in people's psyche the idea of a D-Day and an H-hour and an attack.
Okay, Susan, it seems not long ago it seemed like they were talking about operation and major operation. That was our impression anyway. What's going on here with the Kandahar push, whatever you want to call it?
Well, first of all, I think there's a reflection that things have not been going that well in Afghanistan. If you look at the incredible hoopla that surrounded the much more modest military, major military operation in neighboring Helmand province just a few months ago, the region of Marja, you recall, was treated by the American press as if it was sort of the second D-Day in Afghanistan. And the stories this week, of course, suggest that a whole new round of fighting has broken out, that despite the sweeping U.S. claims that they were going to be unpacking a government in a box and creating
right. Lost Susan. The government in the box, Jack, didn't show up there in Marja. So maybe it's giving them some pause on what we should expect in Kandahar.
Oh, indeed. And of course, the extra complication in Kandahar that the governor of that province is the president Karzai's brother. He's implicated variously, or at least allegedly, in drug smuggling and in militia running and in shaking down convoys of supplies and so on. And, you know, to deal with that satrap, they need a better government out of the box than him. That's for sure. You know, this week, the Center for American Progress, than which there could be no more friendly institution toward the Obama administration, did a report on Afghanistan. And they asked people in the administration, what's the end game? What do you see here as the desirable outcome? And they had to confess that they had no good answer. The real answer seemed to be, let's get the 2012 election behind us, and then we'll see. In other words, what's going on in Afghanistan now really almost looks like a political holding operation to keep the president from being criticized and being weak on defense, so that he keeps this enterprise going, this intervention going in Afghanistan, even when in the face of its palpable failure and the failure, above all, of this government to be legitimate.
Here we are a week after Karzai was in town. Let's go to Pablo in Columbia, South Carolina. Pablo, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom. Huh? I just have a comment and a question.
Mm-hmm.
My comment is that I used to live in California. I'm from Mexico originally. When I moved here, this was when I was younger. I'm not proud of this, but when I moved here, I used to sell minor drugs, and a lot of the people I sold it to were Americans.
Yeah, okay.
Who came to me for drugs. You know, I didn't go to anyone and tell them, hey, I'm going to shove these drugs down your throat. You know, people came to me, so there was a demand, so I provided the supply. So my question is, with that said, my question is, do you think the drug issue is because of the demand or because of the supply?
Pablo, if I may, while we've got you, are you legal now, Pablo? Do you have your, you know, residence settled in the U.S.?
Yes, I am now. It took me a long, hard time, but I am now.
We're glad you got that. That's great. What did you make of the Mexican president's visit to Washington? Do you think he was saying the right things to the United States, to Congress, the president?
Yes, I think he was, compared to the previous president. I think he was. I don't know how genuine he is, but I think he was asking the right questions.
Susan Glasser, there's Pablo sort of making it very real. You know, he came across, he fed a demand. All of Mexico, or a lot of it at the border, is feeding a drug demand here right now, and the Mexican president talked a lot about that, as well as you know, where the guns came from for a lot of the killing that's going on down there. But Pablo's pointing to this sort of two sides of responsibility for that traffic.
Well, there's no question that this is a drug market, and the market is here in the United States. That said, President Calderon is engaged in arguably a failing war much closer to home than the failing war in Afghanistan. And what's been extraordinary is, you know, the U.S. has agreed under President Bush, and it's been renewed under President Obama, to spend a very large sum of money on something called the Merida Initiative, designed to shore up the drug war that President Calderon has unleashed in Mexico. Not only does that not appear to be succeeding, but the levels of violence are absolutely extraordinary. You have what Tom Ricks on foreignpolicy.com mm-hmm. refers to as the classic signs of an insurgency now taking place in Mexico, targeting of local police, local government officials. In fact, there was a high-level kidnapping just the other day. You really have a sense that the government's own control of the situation is being seriously undermined by its own efforts to crack down on the drug fighting inside Mexico.
And the Mexican president telling the United States, please, can you stop this flow of guns from, open gun ownership America? Here he is speaking yesterday to a joint session of Congress.
There is one issue where Mexico needs your cooperation, and that is stopping the flow of assault weapons and other deadly arms across the border.
Jonathan Weissman, the White House put on the full bells and whistles for this president's visit, only the second, I think, state dinner in the time of Barack Obama in office. How did they the visit went?
Well, it's very interesting because the Mexican president, Felipe Calderon, was very forthright in his criticism. When he, standing right next to the president,
yep.
he called the Arizona immigration law discriminatory.
Mm-hmm.
He called on the president to move on immigration reform. All the president really could do was throw up his hands and say, I don't have the votes. He went to a Congress that has shown itself to be hostile, very hostile, to gun control laws, and asked for them to help him stem the flow of guns and money south of the border. And he said that the United States is not doing enough right now to help with this drug war. But all in all, it was
maybe not doing enough, but we'll have to track what he's going to do. Let's get a call right here. Lily in Boston. Lily, you're on.
Hey, my name is Lily Wong, and I'm part of the Student Immigrant Movement of Massachusetts.
Thanks for
the
calling.
National Network United We Dream. Thanks. I just wanted to comment about the little girl and her mother's immigration status.
This is the one Michelle Obama and the Mexican First Lady, Margarita Zavala, went to the second grade class in Maryland. And can you remind us what happened there, Lily?
The little girl, the 7-year-old, I believe, second grader, asked Michelle Obama that she heard that that Barack Obama was deporting people without papers.
She told Michelle Obama that her own mother did not have proper papers, and I'm looking here to quote, the tape was too fuzzy, but the quote says, my mother says Barack Obama is taking away everybody that doesn't have papers, this 7-year-old girl said. What do you think, Lily?
Well, when I heard that, I really heard the innocence in the girl and the urgency for comprehensive immigration reform and the DREAM Act. And just 2 points. It would be illegal for the child's school to check the legal status of the girl and to not educate her. And also it reminds us that people who don't have papers aren't just people or numbers. That this is about the girl's mother and children just like her and their families.
It was a very human moment, a very real moment. Absolutely. I'm glad you mentioned it. Jonathan, I think the White House came out and said, we're not going to pursue this case. We don't want to go after somebody on the basis of what a 7-year-old said in second grade.
Right, but it was a painful moment. You know, this is one of those classic First Lady moments where the First Lady of the United States brings the First Lady of Mexico
yeah.
to a picture-perfect multicultural elementary school in the suburbs of Washington and gets confronted by this child who says, your husband is taking away all the people without papers. And the fact is that there have been more deportations in the first year of the Clinton administration, I mean the Obama administration, I'm sorry, than in the Bush administration, and the White House has been bragging about their stepped up enforcement of immigration rules and of border controls, and it it's supposed to be a way to ease passage of an immigration reform bill by saying, look, we're doing our part, we're getting tough, now you got to help us with the harder political parts. But, you know, he's not moving forward on those parts. And, you know, he's got a liberal base and immigration groups who are really, really upset. And the image of this little girl confronting in this very innocent way the First Lady was really quite shocking.
Jack, I mean, there it is, right in the middle of American society, picture-perfect school, and there's the two first ladies and the issue that doesn't go away.
That doesn't go away. And as Jonathan said, I mean, deportation's way up. Apparently, according to one estimate, it may be as many as 400,000 people will be deported this year, and about 70% of them for non-criminal offenses, you know, being caught up in dragnets and so on. And some for even using things like unauthorized phone cards. So, yeah, we have this. This is supposedly earning Obama grace for general immigration reform, but that does not seem to be on the horizon. And studies I've seen of Hispanic American mood and voting show a close to despair with Obama there, and with the Democrats that they delivered big for him, 2/3 of that vote. And he will not seemingly commit political capital, admittedly depleted now, to this issue.
Well, he's watching that fever on the Arizona border and other borders as well. Susan Glasser, we need just a quick insight from you on Iran. This is a big deal. Nobody knows where it's going to go. Talk of a deal this week with Brazil and Turkey in there negotiating with Iran to take out some of that low-enriched uranium. At the same time, Hillary Clinton moving ahead at the UN towards sanctions. Here's Brazil's foreign minister in the middle of it all, Celso Amorim, saying that the agreement they struck about getting uranium out of there was a good first step toward easing international tensions over Iran's nuclear program.
Of course, this agreement that we wrote today will not answer all the questions, but it is the precondition, in a way, for continuing the negotiations. That is what other countries have always said, that it was necessary to have this agreement, the swap agreement, in order to continue the conversation.
Susan Glasser, there was talk of this kind of shipping the uranium out some time ago. Now it's back just as things get tight in the UN. What's going on?
Well, that's right. I think it's a major sort of diplomatic ploy to see if there's a last-ditch effort on the part of some of the world's emerging powers to trump the big powers at the United Nations who are moving forward on a sanctions resolution. It was no accident that Secretary of State Hillary Clinton made her big announcement the morning after this deal brokered by Brazil and Turkey with Iran. She said, wait a minute, guys, we have progress on a new draft of a tougher resolution at the UN. We're looking for Russian and Chinese support on it. And I think what's really interesting is not only what's Iran going to do next, but you see the emerging contours of this diplomatic struggle playing out. Brazil and Turkey are rising powers. They are looking to play a bigger role on the world stage. They're saying, hey, U.S., hey, Russia and China, you don't get to make all the decisions anymore. We're going to show you that we can come in and do something that you're not capable of doing. That said, as you pointed out, this kind of a fuel swap deal was on the table before, didn't come to anything. It might just be a yet another ploy to sort of buy some more time for Iran on this continuing nuclear issue. The U.S. also is sort of playing fast and loose with this. How much do Russia and China really support what the U.S. is trying to do with sanctions at the United Nations? It's not actually clear yet.
Yet again, we watch this space. Robin in Schenectady, New York. Robin, you're on the air.
Hi. I was calling about the oil spill, and I understand. I want to say I understand there's Superfund oil cleanups all over the country, but this one's in the news. And if I was saying, thinking that, you know, if somebody injured me, broke my jaw or something, I would not let their doctor take care of me. There is no excuse to let BP clean this up. The U.S. government should be having everybody else but BP cleaning this up. It's an outrage that we're letting them mess this up.
Robin, you've got your finger right on the point that a lot of people were paying attention to this week. We've got tape here from the National Wildlife Federation's president and CEO, Larry Schweiger, before the House Transportation and Infrastructure Committee on Wednesday. He said he can't believe BP is still in charge of the cleanup.
The Gulf of Mexico is a crime scene, and the perpetrator cannot be left to be in charge of assessing the damage or controlling the data that flows to the public. In contrast to the sudden impacts of the Exxon spill, the BP blowout is a slow-motion catastrophe, gushing oil from the very depths of the ocean floor, beyond view of most cameras.
But not of all cameras. Live video now of that leaking BP oil well. Here's Massachusetts Congressman Ed Markey saying that footage shows just how bad the leak has become.
These videos stand as a scalding, blistering indictment of BP's inattention to the scope and size of the greatest environmental catastrophe in the history of the United States.
Big words and an awful lot of oil down there. Jonathan Weissman, is this going to end up on the White House face?
Well, you know, I sympathize with the caller's concerns, but the fact is that I don't think the United States government knows what to do. This is an oil gusher coming 5,000 feet under the water, a mile deep, from an oil deposit that's even further down into under a mile of rock.
But is that the point? I mean, the BP sort of shut out most of the country when it comes to figuring out how to solve this, and for a long time, the U.S. government let them do that.
That's absolutely right. And the U.S. government and BP is acknowledging, we didn't really prepare for this. The U.S. government didn't prepare for it either. Everybody, you know, Steve Chu, the Secretary of Energy right now, is kind of shooting out ideas. Hey, why don't we try this? Why don't we try that? But he's a scientist and a Nobel laureate, but he's just shooting in the dark, too. Nobody really knows what to do. It's a very, very scary situation.
Lots and lots of lament around this and some very tough critique from scientists and oceanographers watching what's going on. We're going to look more at that on Monday right here on this show. Jonathan Weissman, White House reporter for The Wall Street Journal, I want to thank you for being with us this hour. Thank you very much for your time today, Jonathan.
Thank you very much for having me.
And Susan Glasser, Editor-in-Chief of Foreign Policy Magazine. Wonderful to have you, Susan. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Jack Beatty, thanks. Have a great weekend, sir.
Thank you, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.